150 years ago on November 24th this year, Charles Darwin published his seminal book On the Origin of Species. While Darwin's concepts of evolution through natural selection have become political targets of religious zealots everywhere, his scientific work formed the basis of much of what is known today about genetics, one of humanity's greatest achievements. For about a century, scientists worked to understand the building blocks of life and heredity. Often seen as one of the most controversial fields of scientific inquiry, this history has now been written by science writer James Schwartz in his book In Pursuit of the Gene, From Darwin to DNA. Through the lives of a handful of crucial figures, Schwartz tells the often messy story of how gene science came to be understood. He now joins me in studio. Welcome to Uprising.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. So it's an important year for Charles Darwin's name. Not only was his book published 150 years ago, it's also the 200th anniversary of his birth. How did his work set the stage for the field of inheritance and what eventually came to be known as genetics?
Well, his theory of evolution by natural selection, which is about selecting from among a large number of small differences in organisms. And it depends, the more fits survive and pass on their better qualities to their offspring. And it depends on there being a large number of variations. But Darwin believed at the same time that that inheritance worked as a blending process, that tall fathers marrying short mothers would have average-sized children. And he realized shortly after publishing The Origin that this was a catastrophe for his theory, because in no time at all you'd wipe out all the variation in a population and then evolution would grind to a halt. So he needed to save his theory of natural selection a theory of inheritance. So he set out to work shortly after publishing The Origin. He got busy formulating a theory of inheritance, which he called pangenesis, which depended on particles which came to be known as pangenes and were later shortened to genes. And those are the conceptual beginning of the modern gene.
And from that work, from that basis of Darwin's work, there were many, many different theories, many competing theories, many sort of arenas of competition and a collegiality between different scientists. And in your book, you sort of show that rather than what some scientists might like to think, that science is the very sort of sterile and plodding field of scientific inquiry, that it in fact is subject to human nature.
Yeah. I mean, that people view science as sort of a dispassionate sorting out of facts, and it really isn't. In particular, right from the beginning with Darwin, his theory, which depended his theory of inheritance now, he postulated the existence of particles that could be altered by one's life. You know, that if you were, for example, there were particles that every cell gave off a particle, which then was traveled through the blood and was collected in the reproductive organs and passed on to your children. But the key point was that if something happened in your life, for example, if you studied hard, then your neurons became superior, then they would give off superior particles, and these would be inherited by your children. Now, this idea was anathema to his cousin, who was named Francis Galton. So, and Galton wanted just to believe that intelligence, in particular, was inherited, and that nothing that happened in your life could affect it. This was a deeply held conviction of his. So, right at the beginning of this, there was this conflict between the two. Even though Galton didn't admit to Darwin that he had a different agenda, his agenda was to disprove the theory of pangenesis. And without telling Darwin about his true motives, he enlisted Darwin as a collaborator on joint experiments to disprove this. So it is an interesting a circuitous route to the truth.
But eventually, somehow, the scientific method, as it's called, has a way of allowing reality to be understood, of real facts coming out, of theories being proven or disproven. How does that happen, and how did that happen in the field of genetics?
Well, I mean, over and over again, you can see a wrong idea, for example, like Darwin's pangenesis idea, giving rise to the right idea, because these ideas are tested. Someone will take up an idea that a previous person has had and tested himself. Or in the case of Galton, someone will be motivated by a private agenda and yet have the right idea. I mean, it turns out that, Galton, for the wrong reasons, was right about the science. You know, that he wanted to believe that that intelligence was inherited, which may or may not be true. But it is certainly true that experience can't affect the genes. And this was tested over and over again in the course of history. I mean, that was in the 1860s. And all the way in the 1930s, again, this idea that what happens in your life can affect genes, this is a Lamarckian idea, was came to fruit in Russia, where there was a big push for these Lamarckian ideas to improve plants by subjecting them to different environments. And so here it was again tested, but here it was a fiasco, and it ended up ruining agricultural science in the Soviet Union. And that was the last reemergence of these Lamarckian ideas and the death of them. And it also actually sort of killed agriculture and the economy in the Soviet Union for about 20 years.
So through the constant testing, the peer reviewing, theories and constant testing of these theories and experimentation, ideas get sorted out, and those that stand the most to the most experimentation prevail, and those that don't stand up do fall by the wayside.
Yes, as long as there's a free testing of ideas. You can't have interference of government, as it was, you know, made manifest in the Soviet Union. It was horrible. You know, that Stalin had an idea about how inheritance should work and imposed it on science, which was he actually made genetics illegal for 20 years. So as long as ideas are tested and allowed to progress forward, I mean, also corporate interests in our country can often interfere with the testing and development of ideas. And you can see it in pharmaceutical companies pushing certain kinds of explanations for the way drugs work, which interfere with finding out how they really work.
I'm speaking with James Schwartz, author of In Pursuit of the Gene, From Darwin to DNA. Part of the history of the field of genetics is the sordid issue of eugenics. And that may be another example of how the sort of frailties of human nature can get entangled in scientific inquiry. Tell us about that in your and how you write about that in your book.
Well, it's actually very interesting the way that eugenics and genetics, the development of both, the evolution of both, are extremely closely tied, because the term eugenics was invented by Francis Galton, who was Darwin's first cousin, and he believed in the strictly hereditarian view of intelligence, and first of all, what he meant by it was that he, like animals and plants, he thought that you could breed better people by selecting the most fit, in his case, the most intelligent people, and allowing them only to breed with each other. And he set out an entire social agenda, and he believed there should be a golden register where the most fit are registered, and that they're only allowed to mate with each other, and that the less fit should be prevented from mating one with another. And in fact, Darwin, who was much more cautious and reasonable, really, tried to warn and mollify, you know, to lessen Galton's involvement in eugenics and keep him motivated towards eugenics. But it's his eugenics passion that kept him moving forward in his science, just both at once. He had noticed, for example, that after his experiments with Darwin, he started to do his own experiments on inheritance. And he noticed that if you bred, for example, peas from large peas, gave rise to plants that gave large peas, but not as large as the parents. And likewise, very small peas gave rise to plants that gave small peas, but not as small. And he considered this regression. He called it regression to the mean. And it was regression to the mean. It worried him because he thought that the natural selection, you know, he was trying to breed a better population, that was his fixation. So he thought, well, it won't work because everyone will regress to the mean. And this panicked him. and regression, and it was actually based on the sort of mystical idea that there was an ideal mean toward which we all regress, which was very unscientific.
Mm-hmm.
But out of this came the idea of regression and the larger concept of correlation, which is one of the cornerstones of modern statistics.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, his biology was entirely wrong. And yet he gave rise – this is a nice example of some of how these two things can go together. He gave – this idea of regression is key and mm-hmm. central to the development of genetics and statistics.
James, how do you make sense of the fact that there is so little public understanding of science and how science works? And in the writing of your book, you know, has the public understanding of science changed over time?
Well, I think that for very abstract sciences like genetics, they're very people are put off by them when they're presented as cold hard facts, and they're difficult to grasp. And my belief is that in the teaching of science, we've sort of gone wrong. That we should present science as it truly evolves, with all the missteps, and in that way, you can see where an idea came from, and have a better chance of, and it's more interesting, a better chance of understanding the complexity of by seeing it in its human dimensions. This is true in genetics. I also think it's true in math and physics. I mean, there's an effort to cover one's tracks and just present ideas abstractly.
And that's where the scientists can be guilty. Of obscuring how the science works.
Right. They don't want to reveal the mess which is behind their work very often.
Well, how has your book been received in pursuit of the gene? And, you know, how important do you think it is for people to understand the way in which science works? And do scientists embrace this history?
Well, scientists are, you know, they have their own agendas. Like, for example, the Genome Project. Those guys, they want to be the inventors of the whole notion that there are complex diseases with complex genetic backgrounds. But in fact, they're not. You know, this history goes back to the early part of the 20th century, to 1913, in fact, when the whole idea of complex traits, polygenic traits, traits influenced by many genes, was framed by the great genius of 20th century genetics, whose name was Hermann Muller. And some people in the Genome Project were very happy that my book revealed the rich history that precedes the current effort to find genes. And you know, others, it takes away from their glory because they wanted to be the de novo inventors of something new.
Right. There's also certainly much to be said for those seeking personal glory in science. But as we've talked about in the end, and as your book reveals very interestingly, the way in which science is, in fact, a sort of community pursuit does allow the truth to evolve and to come out in the end.
Yeah, I mean, another great example of this is that there was a wrong idea about evolution, that it went in great leaps, and this idea was laid out in detail by a Dutch botanist named de Vries, and it was in pursuing this idea, in looking for species inventing mutations, that the modern classical genetics arose. That in a fruit fly, it was while looking for a species inventing mutation that white eye, which is the beginning of classical genetics, was found.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. James Schwartz, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
The book is called In Pursuit of the Gene, From Darwin to DNA. And for Sonali's Subversive Thought for the Day, Ralph Waldo Emerson once said, men love to wonder, and that is the seed of science. That's Ralph Waldo Emerson. That's Sonali's Subversive Thought for the Day.